Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WESA's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Bob Wallachy. Bob Wallachy's new book, A Roomful of Trees, by Redbird Press, will be published this spring. His work has appeared in Stone Highway Review, the Pittsburgh City Paper, the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, and Transient Publishing. Most recently, he has won second runner-up in Finishing Line Press's Open Chapbook Competition 2013. He is a guest editor of Blast Furnace, an online poetry journal, and curates a monthly reading series, Versify, at the East End Book Exchange. Hi, Bob. How are you?
Good, Jan. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we've been looking forward to this, and I'm glad to have you on. And congratulations on your new book.
Thank you.
That's really exciting.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. Okay, so go ahead.
Okay. This first poem I'd like to read from the chapbook is called When the Sunlight. If I said one word about it, I couldn't. The body inside the body inside the body stays still, like a lake being dragged for a body. And when he says, don't tell anyone, it is sunny. And when he says, come here, you were nine. And when it happens, I like you, smile for me, don't think. When he touches you, think of trees. And when you say no, he'll say, I'll kill your parents if. When he touches you, think of the wind. Think of the hard voices of birds through the open trees, their wardrobe of leaves, the leaves falling like cloth, like a thousand hands softly. And when he says, touch me, right here, think of the space over his tall shoulders between the trees, the sliver of light through the gaps, reaching you here and now and always, forever and ever, world without end. Amen. This next poem I'd like to read is called Red. The day my mother drove through Red, the day we saw him, it was the soccer field. The uniforms they made kids wear those days were short and tight, cut you above the thigh, made that way for running. I was the backup, the replacement. Every game he sat, top bleachers, always looking, no wedding ring, never blinked. And I watched him too, till it was my turn, till I was called for and had a turn, had a show in my back with my name printed on it, white block letters on red. I didn't know what it meant for him to see our names on our pullovers. Our mothers were smiling and waving. And before I knew, he was the priest from the youth group. He came and came and came every week until someone noticed. And the children that knew him came to him. Jesus said, let the children come to me. I remember when he watched us, the pines that bordered the field would sometimes bristle in the windless air, the piles of needles fallen and sparkling. There was no name for the wind yet, or the space between his staring, trajectory of air, velocity of wind before a storm happens. There was only one child. No one knew him. He didn't say anything. It took years. And I was already turned around. I was running. I could feel eyes on my back with my name printed on it. And when the ball comes, stopped at my feet, the cage waits, and a blackness opens, to my kick cutting wide into the missing air. Later, on the ride back, the talk turns from the loss to my father about opening, how he heard that doe, a shattering of branches, then gunfire, how sometimes there's a trail of blood. He said how deer take great pains to hide when you shoot them. They just don't want you to find them. This next one is called The Boy. Today, when the neighbor boys are beating the bejesus out of the kid next door, it's because of his clothes and the way he walks. I hear the garbage truck. Last time, they forgot two bags. And now, I'm watching his collar pulled, books dropped and tripped, jaws crushing coffee grounds, empty cartons of eggs, ripped shirt, bloody nose. The arms push it further. Next house, there's a couch without springs and some old computers, and he's lying on the sidewalk where they left him. And the other boys will part ways, go home, or out to eat because it's Friday. And two more of them will walk together because they are friends, still laughing about it down the street. What I saw taught me how to stand by, how to say nothing. It was cold, bright, the kind of light that catches a window of a neighbor's car door when it opens. And for a moment, you can't see anything. Matt. When we talk about what I like with my eggs, mushrooms, and cheese, some onions, John parts the curtains. His mother's lace, off-white and yellowing. He talks about the first time Matt's parents found him in a dress he couldn't unzip himself out of. And so, when he limped out of the bathroom into his room, he fell down the steps in blue taffeta, broken shoulder, his family watching. Even the dog stops licking himself. John keeps mixing the eggs. And when the car comes, everyone reaches for their black and blue coats. Autumn sunlight, flashing off the windshield, which seems to light up the inside of the room for a moment. And John turns the picture of Matt toward him so he can see him.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Bob Wallachy. He's reading from his new book, A Room Full of Trees, which is going to be published by Redbird Press this spring. Bob, I really like the bravery of the poems that you've been reading, and, you know, poems about sexual abuse, I think, are really tough to write well, and yet you do that. Can you talk about the challenges of writing about trauma without falling into, you know, pitfalls such as, you know, being overly dramatic or being didactic, et cetera? I think it's a tough topic.
It is. For me, I take a lot of inspiration from some of the poets I admire, like Sharon Olds, Murray Howe, poets that write with emotional restraint. And I think it's important to just report it, just tell it like it is, allow the reader give the reader some credit and allow their emotional intelligence to enter the poem. And I think a poem will unravel and will kind of wrap themselves around you that way. That's what I try to do. I just try to tell it like it is, just remember how it happened, not add too much emotion, but not be too cold either. It's a delicate balance to have, and it's something that I like to do and I work hard at, and I see that a lot in a lot of poets that I admire.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that you say emotional restraint, because I feel like there's so much emotion in your work, and maybe it does rise from the restraint. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure, but I really feel that's a strength of your work. Do you agree with that? Or?
But I guess in trying to not be too over-the-top dramatic is the sort of line that I try not to cross, and sentimentality. Although as poets, we do care about a lot of things. And I was kind of, in a lot of contemporary poetry, I see a move away from that. And, I thought, wait a minute, you know, we are feeling, living beings. We want to feel. We want to feel these things. Let's express that. So that's been my aesthetic something that I hold very dear.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Can you read some more poems?
Sure. This next poem I'd like to read is sort of a continuation of the Matt poem. John has just lost his partner, Matt, and a friend of mine, and I'm going to a party after this has happened. Some weeks have transpired, and John is leaving in this party, and this poem is called Touch. I said I would do salad for the party, which meant I would bring the big wooden bowl from home. I know it's the one you have to be careful with. If I scraped the bottom, or if anyone touched it, they would feel the long, sharp pieces of wood lifting off where it's starting to unravel. John said he was leaving, and I said that was good. And I can smell the lemons on the sill he hasn't done anything with. His lemon tree in the back has started dropping them, he says, and he passes me with some of Matt's things. And there's a thin strip of air and blue-gray cloud where the window doesn't go down all the way. And John goes downstairs to pack things in boxes. Matt's wigs. Matt's feather boas. He said, don't say anything, and I didn't. He said, you're not like us, so how could you understand? That day, I came to set up. No one was there, but the Good Luck John banner was draped over a chair, and the candy was spread out on trays, purplish foil skirts with chocolate cherries, meltaways. And when John's friends come in, they're smiling. The door is held open for the next person, and if anyone got in line by the food table, they're handed a plate. I remember how the hands of strangers touched or hugged, fingers on someone's neck, a hand on a wrist, a kiss. The light is weird in the kitchen where I say goodbye to John and he hands me back the bowl empty. When the cold enters the room, I know without looking that the door is open. Someone holds it for me, then moves out of my way. They know I couldn't bear it if they would touch me. A lot of the poems in this book have to deal with the death of my father, and I'm going to read a couple of those poems. It's actually the arc of the book. This first poem is called What the Light Wants. Not the tall branches above me rocking and breaking. Not the dead branches over tree lines too high to touch. We walk over grass, soft blades falling. The spot we pick is at the edge of the field. When the wind blows, rows of pines drop and brush needles past our faces, hitting our backs or landing silently around us. Jan hands me the shovel. I can feel that slight give of earth when I bear down. The pole would be first to support his back, then clothes for the scarecrow, my father's flannel, madras squares quilted and blurred. I hold his shirt up, and the suddenness of the neighbor's house comes back to me. It's rained over windows, the mud-slick hill, running away from shut doors. In my father's room, there was a lack of air. When he breathed through the tube, my mother would praise him. Now I'm sliding on his pants, wool shirt over woodpole arms, my sister watching, hands on her hips. She doesn't know I'm building a man, stuffing him with dead things, hay on a stacked pile, loose shoots of grass cut to exactness. I have to leave him here, long stems and thistle. The crows take pieces of him off with their beaks. A few tangled lengths cling to the seat of a tractor. There are parts of him everywhere. This next poem is called Enough. The next day, the lights were still on from the night before, or it was sunny. Coming home from church dressed in black, and someone reaches for the remote, or someone asks you about the children, how are the children, and it's Sunday, so there's got to be a football game on, and honey, how are you really? Behind me, the door swings and slams the wind. Each time, the room is filled with relatives, and the fan swings on its axis. The clip-on angel sways from the chain end. And when the kitchen door closes, she slips away to tilt her head back, blink 15 times, whatever it takes, to peel back the layers of foil, make sure everyone has enough. And the day passes. Someone scores, and someone yells at the TV, and the food is left out. And late into the day, someone is still walking up and picking from it. And the men have gone off to play cards till 3 a.m. And the women talk outside. If there's a garden or a veranda to look at, I don't remember. No one sleeps. But every so often, someone gets up like on a shift or doing the rounds for security. And they might open the fridge, then shut it. Or go back to the food that's been left out and pick at it. I don't know why it was that every time it happened, how everyone seemed so hungry. How none of us could get enough.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Bob Wallachy, reading from his new book, A Room Full of Trees, by Redbird Press, which will be published this spring. There's a lot of wind and air in your poems, and really great references related to that. In one of your earlier poems, there was a line, "There was no name for the wind yet," and it seems that often there's talk about spaces between things, whether it's bodies or the light and the trees. But this air thing keeps coming back. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. Initially, when I write a poem, it just kind of happens and it occurs to me, and I feel like I can write a poem. I consciously think about metaphor, but when I sat and thought about this a while, the artist, Carl Huseman, that did a wonderful job on my cover, was asking me about the cover, and it got me to thinking more about the metaphors in this book. And the thing with the wind is I sort of view it as a force in nature, a force in life that we can't control, that just affects things, and we feel that we're just waiting for things to happen to us. We have control of our lives, but there are things that happen that we have no control over, and I think the wind is sort of that driving force. It's invisible, directionless, the feeling that we don't know what's around the corner, and I sort of view the wind as sort of that force that we can't control, that we just wait for it to happen. And the air, the meaning behind the air and the space between things is sort of like it actually ties into the cover. And sort of my feeling about a room full of trees is sort of like the elephant in the room that everyone sees but no one talks about. And it's all around us. The grief, the trauma, the death, and how families deal with death by compartmentalizing. And that's sort of my take on what the metaphor means to me.
Well, that's a lot. but it's definitely there. I mean, not just the words, but that feeling of being pressed in or being let through, you know, depending on the poem or the moment of the poem. So I think it's really working. I wanted to ask you briefly about the monthly reading series, Versify, that you curate. Could you tell people about it in case they don't know about it?
Yeah, sure. It's held at the East End Book Exchange in Bloomfield on Liberty Avenue, and it's the third Saturday of every month. We typically have three readers. Just this year, I've started to mix in some prose writers, some short story writers, and so I'm excited about that. We have some big names coming up in our lineup this year. We're going to be featuring Terrence Hayes, Toy Derricotte, Joan Barr, a lot of just Pittsburgh is so full of so many great poets and writers. It's really easy to fill up several years without repeating anyone. I've gotten great feedback on it. It's just been a joy to work with, and it's my passion really to welcome this whole family of from the different walks of life and the different groups, the Mad Women, the New Yinzers, and all these people, and sort of bring them together in this poetic community that is Pittsburgh, because it's such a rich and vibrant literary community, mm-hmm. and I'm proud to be part of that.
Well, you're doing a great job, and that series is just terrific. So,
thank you.
And the East End Book Exchange is an independent, or is it a cooperative business, or
how? No, they're an independent used bookstore.
Okay.
I walked in there one day and I just looked around, and this was before a lot of these readings were going on. I said, look, this would be a great place to hold a reading. And it sort of went from there. So,
okay. Could you read more poems?
Sure. This next poem I'd like to read actually got its genesis from a workshop that I was involved with Lynn Emanuel, where we had to write a poem about a place in our life, in our history, in our memories that held a lot of meaning for us. And this is actually the first poem I wrote in sections, and it just kind of metamorphosized that way. And anyway, I'll just read it. It's called The Way Back. 1. Somewhere there is a way back in, through a word like recollect or lattice. Somewhere the way through is the path to her house, where your feet disappear in the mud-sucked earth, the place where ground turns to water. Call it a river. You were young. Two. The way grass has grown high, the way ash from the fire nurtures soil. Three. Today, I'm on the hill where her house was. I draw the floor plan in the air with my finger, and the white door swings open. The room opening to waves, deep swirls of brown paneling, rippled and pulled from the wall because of the heat. The ceiling's cumulus plaster crackling, her big house settling. The built-ins still packed with porcelain ducks and singing angels. And I'm trying to remember that wall where her daughter on a Saturday. It was raining and her friends had dates. My mother, listening to jazz in high school, took her brushes, never painted before. But suddenly the wall was filled with hemlocks and deer drank from streams, walking out of the wall, down the street past me, and somewhere past me there was water, a stream. Somewhere there was a way back in. Her kitchen windows steaming from heat. A blurry view of the Allegheny. The gray barges, like grave markers, pulling steel. Her mother at the stove, back turned, disappearing into the mist. Four. I am downstairs when the last of her things are boxed up. In the photograph I asked to keep, nothing moves. It is 1933 and she is standing in a bread line. It could have been minutes or hours. No one owns a watch. Time is the length of space between each of her footsteps, the time it takes to get inside before they run out. And I'm trying to remember the last time I touched her. I hold the photograph up to the light. My thumb touches her face, but she doesn't notice. The distance is clear, but no one can see past it. Five. The way a door shuts on its own, the way the wind lets go of my hand. Six. When I stepped back outside and the house disappeared. Seven. In a room she won't remember, I sit on the edge of her bed. We are somewhere and the light is coming through the open blinds, the thin slats splintering the air. And I wait until you open your eyes to tell you it is morning. I'd like to read some new poems now. This is another poem about a photograph of my mother, and it sort of just spurred on this poem. It's called Frozen. In the years before color, she stands on broken asphalt, looking up as if waiting for something. Black trees, the sky in grayscale behind her, Marlboro wind, dry breath, fog, exhaustion escaping her lips. The tip of a cigarette where she leaves a kiss. Everything is here before it will happen. Her wrist before the arthritis, her knee pain, the stroke that waits in the quiet rooms of her brain to explode. She wears the windbreaker her daughter bought her with the seam ripping at the shoulder. The house, the broken porch railing behind her. How one flash and a click happens and everything stays frozen. Except for a piece of thread at her elbow, that small unraveling over time. The daughter's divorce, the children she will hardly ever see. In a photograph that captures every detail and holds it suspended, every pore in high-definition silence. No one can tell her what will happen. No one can prepare her. But now, what I wonder most of all is who will be here? Who will find this picture in a box someday, run the smooth length of her face with her fingers? Wonder, who loved her, and whom did she love? Look at the blank white back for a date, a name, and find nothing. I went through a period of time where I was struggling with which to write about. I wrote this book, and I sort of exercised some of those demons. And I was struggling for some inspiration, and I was on hold with the credit department because I had to get a credit report done, and I was on hold so long that I had the idea for this poem, and an idea to write poems about everyday things that people don't think of writing poems about. So this poem is called Credit Rating. On the phone with the credit department, you can hear it. Slight static, giving itself away to music, brittle and raspy. Classical while you wait. Beethoven's string quartet in G, accompanied by violin, viola, a rich-sounding cello, and that familiar voice. Someone will be with you shortly. All of our customer service representatives are busy assisting, and please hold for the next available. The music is beautiful, but you are not thinking of glissandos. Sweet pull of a bow against the rush of aggravation. Something you swallow won't stay down. Something pulling you back down from heaven, placing you in a beat-up kitchen chair with low light, a floor at your feet, with the dust of everything in your life you haven't swept up. And yet, you wait for it. Wait for the voice of someone to tell you enough time has passed, the debt forgiven, the term expunged from your public record. All it will take is a phone call, one email, press one to accept, two to transfer, three to end this call now. But how can this be enough? You have a bed, a front door that works, a car, a job to go to. But how can you forget the children that aren't yours? The fights, the phone call slams, the door pounding at 2 a.m. by someone calling themselves your sister, wide awake and holding a half-open suitcase out to you, stuffed with baby clothes. Here, take this. And you, holding the door open like a phone, a voice in your hands asking, what is your name and how can I help you?
We have time for one more, I think, Bob.
This next poem I'm going to read is, again, from my chapbook. This actually is another interesting poem. We had to write an acrostic poem for an exercise, and something that I had never done before. And of course, acrostic, for those of you who know, acrostic poem, the first letter of each line has to spell down a phrase or a word. And this phrase that this poem spells out is, will I see you again? So you can figure that out from the poem as I read it, where the lines fall. It's called acrostic, Winter Moths. What it means to see them now is knowing they're still here fluttering like pieces of sky, the whiteout they called for, lusterless air, new frost sparkling, ice covering the half-dead pines. Something makes me look in your car every morning for your sweater, for the wind to pass this way, erase the memory of you. You cannot understand what a closed drawer means, or the arms of soft things, threadbare, folded. Under the yoke, your car sits, window half rolled down, and the moths from somewhere have gotten in, gradually falling, some half flying, arcs of light I cannot save. Inside of midnight, everything covered in white, new snow falls, there's nothing I want.
It's the poetry of Bob Wallachy, and he's reading from his new book, A Room Full of Trees, by Redbird Press, which will be published this spring. Thank you so much, Bob. That was great.
Thanks, Jan.
You've been listening to Prosody, WESA's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in every Saturday morning at 6:30 for Prosody, 90.5 WESA.